Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. It's a wonderful political affairs talk show. We represent the political left, right, and the middle. And on the left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hello and hey, listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, always great to be with you and good to be in studio.
Yes, not on a bus.
We lost you. It was so stressful.
Faithful listeners, I went off and you didn't know if I'd gone off a cliff, I guess, or something. Or...
Well, you know, your video froze up. We couldn't hear you. Clearly, your recording was still working on your side, but we just had to toss it back and forth and go unsupervised.
Make it work. Well, a couple of quick just follow-ups to that. We have some loyal listeners, and I learned about Kay Steed. She's a longtime loyal listener in Cache Valley. I just want to tell Ms. Steed, thanks for listening. We love that you care, and I understand she's a political moderate, so I got someone in my
camp. Okay, well, I have a shout-out. Not totally sure of this person's politics, but Jason Runyon tweeted at us. I don't know if you saw that.
I
sometimes get overwhelmed by Twitter, but hey, thanks for listening, Jason. Glad you're tuning in.
John, any loyal listener you want to shout out to?
Well, I have to admit, it's public radio, so they don't want to admit that they actually listen.
For the political right. Well, boy, it's hot. At the Gardner Institute where I work, our HVAC went out. I've been without air conditioning for about 2 weeks. I guess I've got two more weeks to go. It was 89 degrees in my office yesterday.
God bless Carrier.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But that does not hold a candle, using a heat metaphor, to what the UK's experienced. I guess London hit 104 degrees Fahrenheit.
And this is very, so deeply unusual. Many homes are not at all built for this kind of heat. There's not air conditioning the way that there is here, largely. It is really amazing to think about. And, you know, we broke our own record here. So we
had... Was it 107 or something
107
like that?
107 last Sunday, which is, I think, the fourth time we've hit that temperature. But the thing that I think really I find both anxiety-producing, but also very... grounding, snaps into focus how difficult this issue is. This is probably the coolest summer that we'll experience. There's no reason to believe that it's not just going
to
get hotter and hotter.
John, the BBC reported that the London Fire Brigade had its busiest day since World War II. I hate all these references to world wars, but here's another one.
Well, unfortunately, in Europe, they anchor some of the events based on world wars.
Yeah.
Tragic situation. But we talk about this heat. I used to live in the Bay Area, and so you don't have a lot of air conditioning in your homes. And I can remember occasionally when it hit 100 degrees, this is in the early 90s, and yeah, it was hot, and there's no AC, and you're just trying to get a fan to get some air blowing or something so you can cool off.
Yeah. Let's talk about the politics of it for just a minute. President Biden is getting a lot of pressure to declare a national climate emergency. Interesting. John, I'm familiar in political communications that we used to call it global warming. And, you know, more than a decade ago, we changed it to climate change. And I know a little bit about the history there. I don't know if you do, but Frank Luntz is famous for this. He's a pollster for the Republicans. He made a point that we shouldn't be calling it global warming, that that's too visual, and that you should be calling it climate change, and it stuck. Your quick comments
to
that.
Well, I always thought they changed it to climate change because you can always be right when it's climate change because it's going to be changing all the time, whether it's hotter or cooler,
well,
it's going to change.
Well, that could have been one of his points, but there's a famous memo that was actually for political reasons to change it, in my judgment.
So tell us more.
Well, just that he wrote a memo. You can go look it up online that essentially outlines the right words to use when we're talking about the surface temperature of the Earth rising and something that makes it a little bit more palatable for people. But that was when I served at EPA. So that was in 2003. I mean, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
So now, Shireen, where we're at right now, seems to me politically like you can actually talk about climate almost wherever you are on the political spectrum. Not everywhere, but...
Yeah, it sure seems like it. Unfortunately, though, of course, we're stuck in these loops because of years of disinvestment and not really planning for the realities that we're facing now. And my preferred nomenclature on this issue is climate crisis, because what we're seeing is massive shifts and aridation. Like when we think about the drying out of the Great Salt Lake, or we think about hotter and longer summers, we think about heavier and more destructive rainfall. When we think about the force of storms that are hitting our shores and the cost of that, the human cost, how many lives we lose, but then also just the infrastructure cost to rebuild. This is a crisis. And, and to think about what we're going to do at this point to roll this back makes... again, gives me some anxiety, but I also think we have
to breathe deep.
I know, but not too
zen,
deep. We need the air. We need the air. But I think that there has to be really focused attention on this, and I'm grateful that we do have some Republicans in our delegation that seem serious about this issue, not as serious as they need to be, but we do seem like we have some movement on this. I'm just worried that almost everything is happening a little too late.
Yeah. John, renewable natural gas looms large for me. I'm familiar with what Dominion Energy does in that case. They have an incredible renewable natural gas plant. I think it's in North Salt Lake. But it takes, you know, this food waste, this biomass, and turns it into methane that would otherwise
be vented.
Then instead it gets transformed into a lower, polluting chemical. But there's solutions. There's things we can do. There's places where we can find agreement.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's a whole lot of solutions. And clearly, when you think about the economy, different folks are changing. They're investing in different activities. There's different mm-hmm. motivators that are going on. It's amazing how fast when market forces start to drive in a certain direction, how quickly things change and how much quicker they can change than the government when it tries to mandate different things. Talking about Joe Biden, though, I'm concerned. It sounds like another mandate, another executive order, and on and on and on. And that's not the way to govern. I get his frustration with Congress, mm-hmm. and yet we do not want to have a president who, in essence, acts like a king, regardless of which side of the aisle they're on.
Sure. But to be clear, when we're talking about the emergency, potentially calling an emergency for climate, one of the things that does is unlock funding for renewable energy projects, right? So that is something that I think should certainly be on the table. So I think we need the kind of urgency that comes with declaring this an absolute crisis. How that money gets put into projects, what kinds of projects are prioritized, I think is to be seen.
Mm. Staying with a global issue, we've got the IMF, International Monetary Fund, warning about a potential global recession. They see it because of Russia's war on Ukraine and what's going to happen with energy supplies to Europe and what that will do to Europe.
I think you've got the broader issue also of the pandemic and the ripple effect over the last couple years with the pandemic and the impact it's had on the supply chain mm-hmm. and lockdowns and other things like that.
Yeah. So if you think about recessions, you're like, well, you have to have shocks, and we have pandemic shocks and war shocks, and you have to have imbalances. We have housing shortages, labor shortages.
Environmental shocks.
Yeah, environmental shocks with climate and different things. And then overheating, that would be inflation, and then policy errors. Whether the Fed waited too long to raise interest rates or whether the federal government put out too much stimulus.
Whether we shut down when we shouldn't have shut down and locked people away and other things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So these compounding, cascading things. And that's why everyone's talking about recession.
Yeah. I feel like you're the person best to guide us through this. What do you think, Natalie?
A wise one.
I get asked it a lot. Listen, you either have a soft landing or you have a short and mild recession, or you have a very severe and long recession. Those are the three outcomes.
But do we ever have a soft landing? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Federal Reserve talks about wanting to do a soft landing, but when do we ever have one?
Yeah. The argument about soft landing is that we've got so much of a labor cushion and demand cushion that they can raise rates without. So there's such low unemployment and there's so much demand that you can do things and get the soft landing. At least that's their argument.
I get their argument.
You want to know my prediction?
The question is, they're saying one thing, but does it ever happen?
Sure.
It seems like they always crash one way or another.
I want the prediction. Let's hear it.
I think this is the predominant view in state government amongst state economists, but this is going to, to the degree we slow down, it'll be more like 2001 and less like the pandemic recession, less like the Great Recession. So mild and short.
Fingers crossed on that one.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that one.
Well, you say mild and short, but I was in Utah County and the tech sector got hit hard. So we had 14% unemployment. So it was not soft in Utah County.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we won't take a quick break. you bring up the tech sector. That's my biggest concern in Utah. Silicon Slopes, and people use the term a Silicon Slopes frost.
Yeah.
That we've seen Traeger have some layoffs. We've seen Divi. There's an article right now about what Google and Facebook are thinking. Some people said that Elon Musk did his thing about returning to work.
Yeah.
Just so he could kind of trim his workforce diplomatically. The tech sector relied on cheap money, and money's not going to be cheap anymore. It isn't.
Yeah. And that's whether it's borrowing, whether it's investors, whatever it might be.
Yeah. Sharina's factoid, you'll like, since 2010, 40% of our state's jobs have been created between Midvale and Pleasant Grove.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's really the economic center. And so that's a big risk to us.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to take an early break because I really want to develop in the next section some of our other things. I don't want to break in the middle. So I'm going to break us now. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. We've been talking about a lot of issues. We ended this segment by talking about the Silicon Slopes frost. And I thought it's worth, John, just bringing up what's been happening with the semiconductor procedural votes to subsidize the semiconductor industry. Tell us a little bit more background. This is at the federal level.
At the federal level, Congress is looking to do grants to the tune of about $52 billion for semiconductor fabrication facilities, or FABs.
Under the guise of national security.
Some arguments of national security, some about supply chain constraints during the pandemic, uh-huh. other things like that, that chips are so important uh-huh. to our economy that the government needs to stimulate it even more and needs to drive it. Now,
and bring them home. I mean,
and bring
that's
it
part
home.
Of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what do you, what are your, do you like that? You don't like that?
No, I hate that.
Yeah,
I
okay. Mean,
first of all, I hate it because it's cronyism. I mean,
picking favorites.
This is one, picking favorites, but a specific type of the tech sector industry. We're going to pick just semiconductors and we're mm-hmm. going to, drive billions of dollars into there. At the same time, we complain about how much money they make. But, you know, for the same amount of money, we could do broad-based incentives when it comes to technology and R&D in the economy, but we're picking favorites with one, and I even hate doing that. I just want the government to get out of the dynamics, stop driving companies overseas with various policies, and capital goes where it's rewarded.
Yeah, sure.
And we want it in the U.S.
This is a classic left-right discussion because the left likes industrial policy.
Yeah.
And the
right. And the right has bought into it now.
Okay, and the right typically doesn't. And the right typically doesn't because they like to let markets do come up with efficient outcomes and not have government mess it up.
Right. So it's like no man is an island unto himself except for John Dougal on this issue right now. I like the idea of finding ways that we can reinforce our infrastructure and needs when we think about all of the things that were slowed down because of our reliance on these chips and not being able to access them. Everything from cars to many of the things where we're seeing some of the greatest price increases mm-hmm. are tied to this industry. When we are bringing good paying jobs back into this country, I think that is a win for the people mm-hmm. of the United States of America. So I can understand certainly some of the criticism about choosing this particular issue, but when we look at the constraints that were placed on the overall economy because of this and think about the opportunities that we have to potentially bring some decent jobs back into this country, I'm all for it.
Interesting. You know, I'll just say that I like government intervention when it comes to R&D. Mm. Okay, I think there's market failures in R&D and that you've got to...
Which aspects of R&D? I mean, that's a pretty broad spectrum. So when you say
enough.
That, what do you mean?
Well, what I'm referring to is that left alone, we will always underinvest in research and development because there are imperfections in who gets the rewards for it. And so by subsidizing it, you'll have the market optimum amount of investment in R&D. Now, the question becomes, what type of R&D do you invest in? What I love is federal grants to universities, right, that are competitive. And that leads to industry. But specifically picking industry and investing in private industries, that crosses the line for me. Mm. So,
And I'm not as much a fan even of research grants for institutions. When the federal government is actually trying to solve a problem, let's say it's national defense and we want a stealth plane and they're doing R&D to solve that problem, I find it much more effective than we're just going to throw money out there and see what flowers will grow.
Well, speaking of throwing money out there and seeing what flowers will grow, I always like to remind people that during the pandemic, when we did the payments back to families for the child tax credit, that reduced childhood poverty in this country by half. So when we're talking about kind of all of these issues, maybe let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
John, Electoral Count Act. This is something that you've brought up. We've got so much going on as we head into midterms. And I want to talk about DeSantis's visit, and I want to talk about Mike Lee's, the most recent poll. But fill in our listeners on what's happened with the Electoral Count Act.
So the Electoral Count Act is what Trump tried to drive through in terms of getting the election overturned. And so Congress, and this is one of my complaints, is of all the things that are out there, why doesn't Congress fix this act to clarify what the vice president can and can't do under this? Mm-hmm. This past week, we had Senator Manchin and Senator Collins announce
two
that they
Republicans.
Have
a,
But no, a no, nice... no.
Anyway, keep funny. Going.
Yeah. Oh, I think oh. a nice pairing.
Okay.
Keep going.
Yeah, well, just the Manchin is the deal maker for the
Democrats.
Yeah,
I got it. Keep so. Going. But, or deal killer, but go ahead.
But, I mean, they have a bipartisan agreement on how to clarify and specify
codify.
Exactly
yep.
what the vice president can and can't do, what his role is, what the role is in terms of the states, and all that type of process.
And you and like it or you hate it.
I think this is a good step
yes,
to say, what is this process? Because
yeah.
this is clearly, at the foundation, a major problem.
Yes.
The confusion around this act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. You want to say anything there, Shireen? Or?
No, I'm excited to see some of this very tangible work being done that needs to be done, I think, to clarify and protect our democracy.
Investing in our institutions and making
it clear.
Ron DeSantis, I mentioned I wanted to chat about him. So governor of Florida, he's been in town this week. Our attorney general has helped host him, as I understand it.
That's my understanding. Various business leaders around the state.
Let's name
he's
some.
Here on Wednesday.
James Clark, Scott Keller, Mark Newman with NOMI Health, Bruce Huff, who's, I think, on the Republican like Central Committee nationally or something like that.
I got a neighbor, Randy Garn.
Yeah. Okay.
So, go ahead.
Well, it's just an interesting. I look at inflection points in politics, and it feels like there's an inflection point going on that DeSantis is emerging as the guy. I remember when this happened with George W. Bush.
Yeah.
He was still governor of Texas at the time. But it's feeling like there's less emphasis on Trump. There's more emphasis on DeSantis. Shireen, are you seeing that?
Yeah, I am. But I need to be really clear with listeners. Ron DeSantis is the person who families right now are struggling to get vaccines for their kids in the state of Florida because he refused to prepare and order them and make them available. So he's making decisions for parents about if their kids can get access to the vaccine or not. This is the same person who is celebrating the Don't Say Gay law, right? This is the same person who wants to ban books. He wants to tell teachers what they can teach. He wants to, we've seen restrictions of voting rights in Florida. This is Sean Reyes' guy. This is not good. Mm-hmm. This is not a good look for the party. And I think, like, for me, I had to go back and just think about some of the most distressing things that Ron DeSantis has done, including very publicly participating in a rally that was very Muslim bashing. There are just like issue after issue where he has really been on, I think, a much more extreme side in some ways of the Republican Party than even Donald Trump.
Okay. All right. And there's others that would say that he's got the policies of Trump, which they like, without all the character flaws and integrity flaws. But clearly you don't feel that, Shireen.
Some real problems.
From the left side of the aisle.
John,
on the right side.
Are you far enough along that he's your guy?
No. I mean, who knows what's going to shake out and who's going to step up. But he's from my perspective, clearly trying to step at the head of the line to say, hey, I'm the guy to pick up and carry the torch forward. And Trump's the guy of the past, but I'm the guy of the future. And clearly he's, from my perspective, positioning himself for that. I think we're going to see a whole litany of Republicans across the spectrum, across the nation, that are going to step up and try and step in there. You know, clearly DeSantis is early on. That can change. I mean, we've seen in past elections people that look like they were front runners that were no-shows.
They fizzle. Yeah, but super interesting that he's in the state of Utah so early.
Yeah.
What do you make of that, John?
Well, I mean, clearly there's money. There's money here for campaigns in Florida, let alone a nationwide campaign.
Well, I also think it's a place where Trump is not as popular as other and so he can get some groundswell here.
Because we remember that Sean Reyes was out on the trail also trying to protect Trump after the election. So it's interesting that he's here hosting Ron DeSantis.
And it's interesting to watch. We got the governor of Florida and the governor of California, Governor Newsom, taking shots at each other. I think Governor Newsom is trying to step up in the line for Democrats to say, I'm the next guy.
In Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so much to come. January 6th, Secret Service, keeping their texts a little too secret.
This is something I learned this week.
And it's a singular. It's not text. It's text.
One text. My understanding is they were asked to preserve their text messages from that day. They were asked, what was it? I think the 16th. So 10 days later.
10 days later.
And then a week or so after that, they were once again. And then they started upgrading their phones.
They're saying it's a migration, yeah.
But you were asked to preserve it before that migration started, is my understanding. And so when only one text is provided from 22 or 24 agents, there's something wrong there.
Yeah, so the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General said in a letter to lawmakers that the erasure took place shortly after the officials requested electronic communications from the agency. That's a smoking gun, Jerry.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been inside a big agency. What do you think?
Oh, well, this is what I would say. My background, D.C., would tell me that these inspector generals, they're resident in the buildings with you. Mm-hmm. They have offices near you and by you.
They're independent of the agency.
They're totally independent of the agency, and they're just watching everything you do. And I've been interviewed by them before, they shine a bright light on the activities in government, and they're shining a bright light here that something's not right. So
very, very troubling. Yeah. As an auditor, very troubling to see that. This is an agency that needs, one, trust of the public, and two, to be impartial when it comes to politics.
Totally.
Right.
And there's something just not right.
No easy transition to the next topic. I want to talk about Uvalde. I want to talk about the police reports that are now coming out. We've seen it since the beginning, but the police findings that there was not a deficiency in training, but a deficiency in acting, in courage, in stepping up for these children. Shireen, I know this is incredibly painful to talk about.
Yeah.
But, the video evidence and the reports, police were there right from the beginning
and had
before he even entered the building.
Yeah. So, yeah. They had the resources. They had the training. They had the structures. They did not deploy their professional duty in a way that is at all acceptable to anyone. And I mean, there's so many pieces of this that we could talk about, but I am haunted by the video. And I know a lot of people are talking about the text that they put up on the video that says the screams of children have been edited out. And when you just think about the horror, these people are standing in the hallway for 44 minutes as people are bleeding out, as children are screaming. And some people kind of try to do some things on the edges, but again, this just is like, there's so many layers to this, I don't even know where to go other than to just express my disgust and heartbreak.
Well, and the officer whose wife was shot and was dying on the floor, and he tries to go. He's got his gun pulled. He's ready to go in there. He's getting stopped by his colleagues to not go. And every day we're learning more and more and more, and the public is getting more disgusted with what I would describe as the incompetence that was exhibited here. And I know this is an area where Shireen and I are probably going to disagree, but the message that on the right too many people are getting is, if you think law enforcement is going to be there to protect you, they're not. And this is exhibit
And on the left, the message is, just because someone's armed doesn't mean it's going to solve the problem.
Well, I feel like that's the message we're getting too. And it seems like that's correct in some cases. I mean, there are so many... there are so many challenges put on police across so many different kinds of communities. But when we think about what we're actually asking police to do in this country, the expectations are unreasonable. But when we think about the investments that we make for these high-stress environments and situations, a lot of emphasis is put on that. And to see just such a critical... we know that people are going to fail when they're responding to a mental health crisis. We see it over and over and over again. We know how racism plays a role in the way that policing is conducted in America. But when we think about all the investment that we put into things like active shooter, to see this kind of failure just makes me feel hopeless in some ways when it comes to this issue.
Well, and then we contrast it with this 22-year-old kid in Indiana who 15 seconds... responded, took down the active shooter in a mall there versus here in a school with almost 400 trained officers.
Yeah. Tough.
So many terrible issues there.
Hey, so getting back to local politics, again, no easy transition from that issue, but Mike Lee and Evan McMullen, new poll of registered voters, looks to be a statistically valid poll, finds a 14-point lead for Senator Lee. I think it's with 15% undecided. So there's that. But Shireen, I'll go to you first.
That's a lot of people that aren't that happy with Mike Lee, to be honest, right? I mean, he's an incumbent senator.
Senior senator.
I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people have yet to really get to know or re-remember Evan McMullen and understand, you know, what he really stands for as a conservative person who believes that we should be doing things like protecting voter rights, not participating in overthrowing an election, really, you know, being somebody who is deeply concerned about the direction that this country is going. I think people, the more they get to know Evan, the more that number is going to get closer and closer. And I think Evan can do it.
Well, I would agree with you that there's a lot to come in this story. Get ready for the campaigning. John, your perspective?
Clearly, if you watch the TV commercials, Mike Lee is running against Joe Biden. That's his opponent. That's what his commercials are on. That's his winning message.
Yeah. Just real quickly, Jen Plum ousted Derek Kitchen. Guess it's final.
Well, these are two friends, and I'm, you know, I have to say, I was well served as I was represented by Senator Kitchen, and I think I'm going to be well served as I'm represented by Senator Plum.
Yeah.
Likely to be.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to Jen.
We got Pioneer Day.
Oh, yeah. Why don't we talk about the last minute? Pioneer Day, what do you do about it? It's an incredible statehood moment for us, but it can be divisive.
Yeah.
I used to be, you know, taken aback when I would see the Pine Beer Day sign in the at the cathedral in South Temple. It took me back. It took me in a bad place because I like to think that the pioneer heritage in the state is something that we respect and honor and welcome everyone. But Shereen?
Yeah, I've noticed that some indigenous communities are also organizing to say, you know, we were here as well, and there's an indigenous side to the story too. But what I hope people can do is, you know, find community, be safe, don't light off fireworks. There's so much to say here, but
John, we'll give you the last word.
A message of religious refugees fleeing persecution, death, and terror, and trying to find a peaceable land to exist. Mm-hmm. And that is the legacy that we have here. My great-great-great-grandfather lost their oldest daughter on the plains coming here.
Yeah.
And that's part of the message of Utah.
Let's welcome everybody and respect everybody. Well, great program. Shereen Ghorbani on the left, John Dugal on the right. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. I'm Natalie Gochner. Thanks for listening.